lot of the contemporary questions of Enron decisions absolutely need a posik. The final word is going to be a psak of a rab. But the metzias and the intricacies and the complications of the situations really requires medical knowledge. It really requires an understanding of what's going on, what the different nuances of the medical therapy means, what are the ramifications. And therefore, this was a very experienced Rosh Hashiva who felt that I should get involved and sent this person to me. And before I knew it, he was calling me multiple times a day. And I'll get more detail as soon as we do some of the materials. I'll tell you the type of questions he was asking. So I like to present this in a very almost sarcastic way to begin with. Wow. If you look at the first page, there is the actual article, and a lot of things about this article impressed me compared to modern day medical literature, medical articles. This is from JAMA, which is one of the most prestigious journals, right? If you ask me, what are the two most prestigious medical journals? It's New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, right? The Journal of the American Medical Association. Those are the big two. When you're in academic medicine, no Alina. Whoops, get in there. Which I was for a brief time of my life. You realize that, you know, there's a lot of pressure to publish, and the more prestigious the journal that you publish in, you know, the better it is. So a goal of everybody is to make it into one of those two, right? So, but apparently standards were different back in the 60s, because to me this is like, this kind of article, the way it's even written over here, would never make it past the first review. Needless to say, or nevertheless, the point of it is incredibly fascinating. This was the first announcement of the discovery of the technique of CPR. Right? This is the first article that mentions such an idea. Before this, if somebody went into cardiac arrest, the only option was to cut their chest open, grab the heart, and start working on it like that, right? Either, you know, put epinephrine directly into the heart, which we still do, or direct cardiac massage, which we still do in very desperate situations, but we have something, you're not going to do it out on the street, right? Have you ever done that? No.
Definitely not.
So, it was a big, unbelievable discovery that you could do CPR with a closed chest, and that's what this is announcing, right? Cardiac resuscitation after cardiac arrest, or VF, which is ventricular fibrillation, has been limited by the need for open thoracotomy and direct cardiac massage. However, and this is when it began to sound to me like this is like some kind of advertisement, it was unbelievable. As a result of exhaustive animal experimentation, a method exists where we can now do it externally. Unbelievable. The use of this technique on 20 patients has given an overall permanent survival rate of 70%. Anyone, anywhere, can now initiate cardiac resuscitative procedures. All that is needed is two pairs of hands. I mean, when I read it, I said, this is like such a joke.
It can be all yours.
Yeah, it's like unbelievable. It's like it's more like an advertisement. So, needless to say, we don't write this way anymore in medical journals. This doesn't get through.
It's too easy.
However, there's so many problems with it, even in the substance of what it said. For example, what do you guys think is the real survival rate after doing, let's start on the outside? In the street, what is the survival rate of initiating CP? No, let me start. No,
depends on where they are.
I don't want to demoralize everybody, by the way. What is the survival rate in hospital arrest where you're going to do a full code and need CPR?
10%.
No, higher.
Not bad. No.
If someone goes into BFib in a hospital, you're talking
about. BFib is not such a big deal. I'm talking about full cardiac arrest, right? When your heart stops, right? So it's probably somewhere around 15-20%, and this is within the ICU, and all the bombs are on top. If it happens on the floor, it's lower, right? So that shouldn't be, because everybody should really know what they're doing. If there's one thing they train you well in a good residency program, is to take care of arrest situations, right? You know a good program if they're really making sure everybody is ready to handle, which is a great skill. By the way, you feel much better when you've been through that. It's like a pain in the neck, you gotta do a whole course if you go to a good place. It's kedai, kedai, kedai. It's the best thing to know. It really is the most mamashus of saving lives. It's really very important. On the outside, that's not that somebody should arrest, 5 would be very generous, right? The only success stories are really, A, if people are really good, which most people are not, they think they are, they watch TV or something. You know, they go through the motions. But you have an advantage in the hospital. And when you get good at it in the hospital, you're much better on the outside also, is you see that when you thought you were doing something, you could see by the monitor that you're not doing a thing, right? The purpose of CPR is to keep the body perfused, especially the heart, long enough so that you can do the resuscitative measures to get permanent state of stability. So you want to keep blood circulating. So when you're doing CPR in the hospital and I have an arterial monitor or a blood pressure monitor, I know that at first I wasn't doing it well. I remember the first time that this hit me was an arrest, my first arrest as an intern. And fortunately, unlike some other people, my first arrest as an intern was with the company of the residents, the attending, everybody was there. That's the, if you have to go through trial by fire, the best way is with all that support. Because they purposely had me do the chest compressions. Not only because I was the woman on the totem pole, right? And it gets very tiring after a while, but they wanted me to learn how to do it right. So there I start. It was like a 4-month baby. And I start to do the chest, and I'm really worried, right, that I'm gonna crack his chest or something. So I'm doing it very delicately. And fortunately and smartly, they didn't give me much time of doing that. Within a few seconds, they said, "You're not doing anything." And they got over me and taught me that you have to really compress. And then suddenly the arterial tracing comes back. So you can see and know that there's a certain amount of force you really have to do, otherwise it's not gonna work. Most people on the outside don't realize this and do very ineffective CPR, so the percentage is very low. The bottom line was that originally, the 70% they're quoting here must have been, you know, like under very controlled conditions for selected patients. It was like an amazing thing, and it was very temporary problems. You know, like somebody maybe their airway got clogged. That was the real underlying problem. So they did a little, and he was arresting because of it. They did a little CPR for like a minute or two. This was an imagine, the only way he could get 70%. And then they unclogged his tube and he immediately came back. So that kind of thing. But there was tremendous enthusiasm, needless to say, for this technique. It really was a big boom. Not too long after, the article right below it, 1976, everything changed. You know, at first was, let's everybody, you know, sell the CPR, everybody do it, we use two hands, that kind of attitude. By 1976, they began to realize, with the advent of ventilators, again, those ventilators are plus, you know, double-edged sword, right, for the medical community. It saves a lot of lives, but it brings all these problems, right, economic problems. All these people were being saved and put on ventilators, who they were going nowhere, right? So a strong pressure group, and this is the first article in the New England Journal of Medicine that describes it, that, and it was Carrie Ann Quinlan, everyone heard of that case, a very famous case, where maybe it's better sometimes that we don't save the life. They began to realize we were saving people and they were putting them into these vegetative states, we were putting them into these chronically ill, painful states. We were doing nothing to save them, really. So maybe we don't really always need to do the CPR. And the whole shift occurred in the emphasis of medicine. It was at first, oh, we're gonna save everybody's life doing CPR, it's the greatest thing ever created, to let's stop doing it. You know, let's make sure that we have an opportunity to opt out of doing it. And so became the concept of DNR, right? Do not resuscitate, right? Do not resuscitate became, if you turn to the next page, something that became state law and all over the country. Now it's all over the world. This option exists, and people have to be very careful in understanding what exactly it means, right? Nowadays, we have the prerogative, certainly in our state, and probably throughout the United States, to be very specific in what goes into the DNR, right? If you look at the first paragraph on page 2, strictly speaking, DNR means, if you only wrote DNR order, and didn't specify anything, what would that mean? It would mean the medical professionals are not to perform CPR. This means the doctors, nurses, and emergency medical personnel will not attempt emergency CPR. What does CPR mean? It means, basically, chest compressions, right, and ventilation through one person, mouth-to-mouth ventilation. That's what it would mean. However, it has been expanded to mean now, if you write DNR, right, that's what the definition of originally was. Now what it's expanded to be, will not administer chest compressions, artificial airway, resuscitative drugs, defibrillator, cardioverter, respiratory assistance, IVs, or cardiac monitoring. Basically, it means now we're not going to do anything. We'll let the patient die.
Can you decide which ones you want?
Yes. That's one thing that you did right up front, is that you can specify in a DNR, and this is what often is the case, as we'll get through this, that we'll say, Lamaisa, tell them not to do chest compressions. Very often you don't want them doing that, because really, when it comes to that, those percentages are really, really low. And you're going to be making a very painful, ugly situation, cracking ribs, right? In an older person, right, I've never had to, you know, really get involved with this, other than I was visiting a friend. Right? If you're in pediatrics, don't visit friends who are in adult medicine, right? Because you can get into the following situation. I'm visiting a friend in the emergency room. We were both on. I remember this. It was middle of the night. We're both on call. He's in on in the ER, I'm on the floor. So he decided we're gonna visit near him. So I go to visit him. And as I'm talking to him, his patient starts arresting. So that was my one experience of an older person's arrest. I'll take a kid arrest any day. Why? The results are 1,000 times better. You know, Baruch Hashem, the percentages I gave you before were for adults, by the way. In pediatrics, we're closer to like 50%. It's a much higher success rate. And you don't make a mess, which means like when a typical old, frail person, brittle person, is undergoing real chest compressions and CPR, it becomes harm.
Wait, can you go over what the Quinlan decision was? Like, how did this come about that? Just because
of She was the most famous case. She ended up in a persistent vegetative state. And it was felt that in the condition she was in at the time, she should not have been resuscitated. That's when she ended up. You know, there was a whole question, she was on a vent. There was a whole question, should we take her off the vent or not on the vent? So they got through that, they decided to take her off the vent. And then she lived for another like 5-10 years. I don't remember exactly how many, she lived a very long time. But she lived in a persistent vegetative state for this entire period. And it was like taking off the bed. It was all economic things, and then there was the emotional human factor that she was in everybody's mind suffering, and the family was suffering. It was a horrible situation that never would have happened had there been a DNR and she wouldn't have been resuscitated. So that was like how it stimulated this, but that was just one case. That was the famous case. That made it to the Supreme Court, and that was all over the news. But these kind of things, it was mice and coyote for all the doctors and all the hospitals.
If there is a DNR and doctors don't listen to it, is there a grounds to sue?
Mm-hmm.
There is.
Okay. Wrongful life. That would be serious. That would be a serious sue. And get a lot of sympathy, because what would happen is, Lo aleinu, practice, and Baruch Hashem never happened to me, but if a person's involved in malpractice suit and there's a death, it's very well known that they get hit for much less than if there's a very severely injured live person. So if you do a wrongful life and the person like is presented in court, this person is in this state because of you, even though the alternative was letting them die, it's big sympathy for the jury, and they award big amounts of money, and it's like, yeah, that's like a million.
Who writes the DNR?
The consent initially comes from the patient. That's why you'll see in many, many hospitals today, as soon as you're admitted to a hospital, they're going to ask you about this, right? They ask you if you have a living will, they're going to ask you if you want to specify, even if you know you're... I don't know if they do, I forgot what age they start doing. It used to be that they only did it to older people, and then now there's like blanket policies. You don't like to hear it as you're going in, you know, for your hernia repair that they start asking. You know, it's just not the kind of thing you want. You're scared enough going into the hospital, right? You don't need to be hearing about
your treatment.
So do you want us to resuscitate you or not? What do you mean resuscitate me? I thought I'm having a local hernia repair. So, but they do. So it's ultimately, ideally, the patient's choice, right? If the patient is incapable of doing it, they'll go to the family. And then the actual order is written by the doctor.
And if we go back to that whole autonomy thing, deciding...
We're going to go ahead. We're going to get big into it in a second. Mm-hmm. Let me just get through the more preliminary stuff. So what kind of situations would we think to do a DNR? So they're obvious. So on page 2, you see I put 2 classic examples. The American Academy of Pediatrics article, he tells you that the purpose of a DNR would be to, bottom line, we want to make sure dying with dignity without pain or distress is the primary goal. right? We want to make sure that a person gets to die with dignity and without pain or distress, so that a terminally ill patient who has no hope for survival, but is just going to be prolonged painful state, that would be a reason to have DNR. Why prolong his suffering? The other context where it's considered is the one from the Journal of the American Dietetic, of all places, I don't know. It's a very funny place for this article. But there, they just, to me, highlighted the other issue is people that are in persistent vegetative states or in a state where they're not having any type of meaningful life, but they're in no pain. Those are two very different situations. We're going to see again, there's a tremendous nafkamina between those two states. According to the secular medical ethics today, there's no difference. Either one is a very appropriate place in their view to have a DNR.
Wait, what?
The first case was pain, and the second case was persistent vegetative state-like situations where the person's not in pain, as far as we know, but he's just not doing anything.
Yeah, but that's not,
he's not going anywhere.
He's only not in pain because he's not in anything. He's just gone.
Okay, so what is he? What's his neshama doing?
He's trying to get out of there.
That's your opinion. I don't know. We'll see how the post can handle it. But you can see there's a very big difference.
What about pain that the
tension
is going to do?
Hmm?
What about the pain that the family's going
right.
through?
Should that be a factor?
Yeah,
so it should be a factor. We can't say it should be totally not a factor. We have to just say, but we have to question how big a factor. In other words, like if you did, we're going to start talking about.
Well, we can't ask the guy there where you want to stay on.
All right.
So you have to.
Let's just. I'm progressively going through this in a certain fashion. So let's leave it at this for now. I don't want to get into this discussion. It's premature. Hang on. Right now, what I'm introducing to you is the two primary reasons people would consider DNR. Pain or meaningless life. Okay? And anybody with a brain could appreciate that this is not irrational to think this way. It's not evil to think this way. We all agree to that, right? We're not talking halacha yet, but in terms of simple logic, we understand why they would feel this way. Of course, the decision to do DNR, because of these two reasons, is up against what? What's it up against? What tells me don't put a DNR? Right? Do a DNR because I don't want this guy to be in pain. Do a DNR because, the side that says don't do DNR is because you can't just, you have no bias over your life, right? You can't just let a person die. Now let's not get halachic. Wait, we step back. Let's just be secular. Let's be secular hypothetically. And say, well, if, and this will come up in a second in the debate, you'll see, let's say in medical school, you have this kind of discussion. So you'll be amazed that it's not only the religious people that are going to be making this second argument. They're going to say, well, it isn't so simple to just say you're allowed to let someone die, right? Even from a secular perspective. Because that's what you're doing. You're letting somebody die, right? So,
what's the problem?
We're letting people die?
In letting such a person die.
And say again?
Letting such a person die.
Oh, so again, I'm saying there's two opposing forces.
And then you said
there's a person in the situation of pain and the person in the situation of a vegetative state. Neither of those are situations I want for more. That's one value. The other one is independent of any state. There's something called life, which is a primary value in society, in an objective way. No, in society, you never heard of the state's obligation to protect the life of every individual in the state. That's an independent secular idea. It's not a
wrongful termination.
No. What happens is when there's a conflict, which wins, that will be maybe different between the secular decision and the religious decision.
Right. Didn't we say that DNR is something that the patient's, that the patient that gives his consent and says.
So what?
What do you mean? He, the person in charge of his own life, said,
Are you talking as a religious person or a secular person now?
Does it not matter? Why does it matter? No matter what kind
we'll
of
see.
Doctor I am,
we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Background, I'm standing there in the guy.
I promise we're going to get right into this. Very heavily. This is autonomy. We're getting ready. Turn the page. Here's something that's very interesting. So, when people, we brought up already, so I'm going to mention, when people talk about the problems they have with instituting DNRs, in other words, many doctors will complain that some patients just don't get it and won't let them do the DNR. Right? And they catch it up. And someone did a study to say, who are these patients that don't do the DNR? What's wrong with them? Right? Don't they realize they're being mean? Right? Isn't that it? Or do they have some kind of unrealistic, what they usually say is they have an unrealistic expectation. They think a doctor can save everybody, everybody's going to be great. Right?
How do they know?
So somebody said, you know what, everybody used to talk about this. What is it with these people that are refusing? Is it only the religious people? What is it? So a guy did a study. That's the study I made sure. He was not in the hospital.
Isn't it that no one wants to believe that his life is going to be the one that can't be saved? Why would I want to believe
that? That's what the authors...
Why would I want to believe that?
The author's hypothesis was that there's unrealistic expectations. That's the reason they're saying no to DNR. Look what the results of the study is. The results of the study show that that's not true. That wasn't the issue. And this was done at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, where I'll tell you it's 40% Catholic, 20% Protestant, 20% Jewish, the patients. And then there's the rest. So the belief that DNR decisions are morally wrong, this was their conclusion, was predicted by certain religious practices. This was unbelievable. You know, they did a whole bunch, they did a real study. They said, they looked at all the variables. They asked the person on a questionnaire, you know, different practices they might have. They didn't come out and say, are you religious and that's why you're against this? That wasn't how they did it. They said, they just asked them their daily habits. And amongst their daily habits were these. Near daily meditation. We would call it tefillah. Right. Near daily thinking about God. A current practice of medication, and by endorsement of the statement, my faith sometimes restricts my action. Those variables came out to be the predictors of somebody who would be against the DNR. So it really verified.
It's not very
deep. The truth is what I would have felt. I would have, if they asked me before they did their survey, I'm not just talking with hindsight, but I really would have said to them, well, it's all a religious question. You know, it is like you all were saying, and I would say also, it seems very rational to be in favor of DNR as an option, right? And also that the patient should choose. It should be autonomy. Mm-hmm. However, you know, this question's not that pushy, and there's other issues.
No autonomy, like,
there's halakhic issues that get involved in this decision, and it's not so pushy. And anyone who's probably against DNR, it's either from, if they're Orthodox Jew, it's a halakhic thing, or some other religion, right, will also have problems based on their religious principles. And that's what this study proved. So my question now becomes, since we're all getting a little uncomfortable, possibly, what is it with us? What is it, what's the religious problem we have with this, right? So what I wanted you to see is that, do we have unrealistic ideas about life and death, that we are like afraid of death? Do we think that death has no place, that there's never a time to die? So the biggest riot against that is Kohelis, right? The Islamos, right? But even more than that, from the Sefer Chassidim, he talks about kisha adam goses, when a person is a goses, on the brink of death, kisha nefesh adam yotze, and the soul is leaving, ain't tzokin alav shetashut nafsho. Don't scream, he should stay alive. Let him go. It's a very, Judaism recognizes, right? Sefer Chassidim, the Bali Tosfos, clearly recognized, as does Yadus as a whole, that there is an Islamos, and there's a time not to, we're not just crazy fanatics, life at all costs. We're definitely not there. And do we not recognize the idea of death with dignity? We certainly do. I gave you two Gemaras right over here. One Gemara which talks about execution, they used to drug up the executed criminals because they wanted him to not suffer at the end. So he had to be executed, but let it be without suffering. And the biggest riot is Amar Rab Nachman Amar Rab Baruch Hu, the bottom Gemara, when it says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, you know what that means? Birur lo misa yofa. Make sure he dies in a pleasant way. Right? So I think Judaism is certainly not living with their head in the sand. There's no doubt, there's no question that we, A, understand there's a time to die. And we're not blind fanatics. And B, we understand that there's significance to dying with dignity and without pain. So it would be stupid to accuse us otherwise, which they do. What prompted me to put in these makaros? Because when I've gotten into debates over this issue with people, they have thought of me and accused me of being somebody, because I'm Jewish and religious, they immediately assume that I'm some fanatic who thinks that there's some absolute holiness to life that supersedes any rational other issue, and that's what's guiding me. And I wanted to tell them, I always would start off and I would quote this, so I wanted to disarm them a little, and let them know that I'm not coming from a crazy perspective. Question.
Last question is, we actually don't value the going on a dignified way. People are letting the death penalty by Jews is quite
gruesome.
Yeah. I mean, pointing at boiling lead down over someone dead, that's actually not that they're like pretty good.
Have you ever seen one?
Never.
It's the way I imagine it, by the way. It's really an isolated case. How many people have a straight as a Nisa? Right? So Bas Cohen gets Messiah. How many other kids?
I don't know.
So I would say that's like representative of the Jewish attitude towards death. I would say this is. That's Chazal's attitude. Executions of criminals or of bas bitik kohanim that are bizarre, it's like exception cases. I don't think that's the representative of the attitude.
So, but no, one thing says we are more than the secretary, because as you point out, the secretary people, when they give the death penalty, they do administer either.
Tomorrow, you have to learn the Gemara Sanhedrin. I don't want to go into this with you now, but you will see that the Gemara Sanhedrin is very concerned with. There's a whole Mishnah that's dedicated to, we got to make sure that we don't have the same ugly execution style as the Romans, right? We're talking about chayav. So it says, we used to chop the head off, it would fall on the ground, we got to make sure we don't do that. It's a whole issue, it's the opposite sort of what you're saying. But except if, we're not into gruesome death.
I was going to say, those death penalties the Jews performed were all a preventive measure, and they never really acted it out. Like only one time.
Right, aside from the fact that, right, that it's a based thing that is the mamis in 70 years is called a katlamis, is a killer day.
All of those parental measures.
Right, right.
So just in the end, I'm sorry to like skip really ahead. Is DNR okay?
Just do. Here we go.
I just want to know, is DNR okay?
Under certain circumstances, yes, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. Not only is it okay, what we're going to see, you want to skip ahead?
I just want to make sure we're going to define DNR more specifically.
I promise you, I'm going to give you something practical. I promise. As a bottom line. We're getting practical, but I don't want you to miss how we got there. I don't want you to miss it. All right, page four. So what's the difference between the conclusions we're going to draw? This is something I just, for my own self-fulfillment, this is just, you're going to humor me with this page. I want you guys to really realize the difference between the conclusion drawn by secular ethicists and us, who are beholden to something else. It really comes down to something we spoke about at the very beginning, which is the standard of ethical decision, right? What is it that a secular ethicist believes in? So everybody has the same tension, again, quality of life versus the sanctity of life. Everybody's dealing with that tension. What will be the most important principle to govern the decision of a secular ethicist? We said it already. Autonomy. That's what will be the single most important. At least they say that. And by the way, they're lying. I'll give you two proofs that it's a lot of baloney. And this is what really gets me on edge about their attitude. They'll throw it in my face. Oh, don't you understand autonomy? We're just trying to protect autonomy.
So, what's autonomy?
Autonomy means that the person himself should get to decide. What you were saying before. In other words, it should always be up to the person. Our agenda is, we have no agenda, no economic. I accuse them of having economic agendas. And I'm talking about cases that I've been involved in where I'm fighting them on a decision, right? The family does not want to do DNR, right? The family does not. So they're going to scream at me, autonomy. I say, but the family says no. So he says, no, the autonomy of the patient. I said,
no, it's autonomy. If you look at autonomy, does that mean whatever is
what
best,
would the
for,
patient
best
have
for him
what
now
would
this
the,
moment or the overall what is best
what,
for his life? And,
what would the patient have wanted
the
decisions
that
to be? What would the patient have chosen on his own? So if we have documented proof what he would have chosen, no one can argue with that. That's it.
So what case are we talking
about? Not Alpidin, by the way. Alpidin in certain circumstances, that's it. We'll see. There's going to be a very heavy sheet. Rav Shechter is very famous for emphasizing his approach to these type of scenarios is very heavy autonomy, you'll see. But they are telling me that everything's autonomy.
Can a patient also say that if anything happens, he's in charge?
Yes, I'm going to show you that. Just look at the last two pages, pages 9 and 10. I just want to show you why I say they're hypocrites. Many of them, not everyone, I'm not going to say every medical ethicist is a hypocrite. But I have often encountered the type of scenarios that I'm about to read to you. Right? Autonomy, right? The reason we want this guy dead is because autonomously he's making that decision to die. Okay. So here's a true story. An elderly man with health problems is admitted to a major teaching hospital. His son was shocked to find that a DNR, do not resuscitate order, had been entered in his father's medical chart. In response to the son's inquiry, the attending physician said, the patient had told the doctor that he wanted a DNR order, autonomy. He wanted it. The son insisted that his father, being an Orthodox Jew, would want to be resuscitated if his life was in danger. Neither the son nor the doctor had anything in writing for the patient, who was now incapable of communicating his desires. Easy for the doctor to say, right? This goes on. The doctor will say, look, right before he went out, he told me, DNR, you know, on his last breath. In this particular story, the son managed to get his father's care transferred to another position, removed the DNR order, treated the patient. Of course, what happens in the story that's reported in this article. The father recovered, had no recollection of any DNR conversation with him. So that's pretty bad. Assuming the story is true, and it would not surprise me if it was, I don't have documentation, but this particular story is factual. But this kind of thing does go on, and even worse is the last page.
Why? How can the son just get the dog? Like, how can he just get the change?
He said, I don't want you to take care of my father anymore, I'm taking a different dog. People do it all the time.
And how did you just get it?
What
is it? The father said he wants DNR, and
that
the son didn't like
he's
it.
In cardiac arrest, they have time to find a new dog.
No, he's not in cardiac arrest. He just found DNR on his chart. If he should go into arrest, let him die.
But
his son says, don't let him die. So the doctor says, but autonomy, the patient chose this.
Incapable of communicating.
He couldn't answer. No one knew what he was
saying.
So
how was the other doctor, whoever, switched to able to
a doctor that
off.
Would ever get caught doing this?
Big trouble, huh?
Just, you know, I can't imagine anyone really taking a chance.
So why would a dog, why would he do that?
He's up
to... How would a doctor do that?
Abdanim l'chaskos. I'll say the reason he's doing it is because he really feels the patient suffering, and he wants him not to suffer. He says these people are primitive religious fanatics. They don't know what they're talking about. For their own good, I'm going to have them die. That's how they're thinking.
Maybe it's possible this older man had Alzheimer's or something like that. He would ignore the conversation either way. They just left that.
No, you can make up any scenario you want, right? This is just an illustration. Here's a true story. Here's a true story. And I myself, this one I've encountered.
You were part of it?
Not this particular one, but like this one.
Tell them that
this better. I will. I want you to read this. Huh? This is from my medical school. This is not a story I was involved in. I was involved in similar stories. A 54-year-old woman with end-stage ovarian cancer was admitted to a teaching hospital with sepsis. That means a bad infection. Throughout her hospitalization, the emergency department, intensive care unit, oncology teams all addressed the topic of DNR. Right? It's always one of the first things on everybody's mind when an old person comes in, right away they start taking DNR. Which already is, to me, sick, right? Because an old person doesn't mean, I'm just telling you about it, 54 in this case, but in general, when they start jumping on DNR, it's like, I just got a call from somebody who's 96-year-old grandmother, who was in perfect health, fully in full control, all her faculties are great, went in and had a stroke. And right away, right, without any question of the severity of the stroke and the prognosis, DNR, 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 they were forcing the family into a DNR. So I get a phone call from this guy. They told me that I really have to do this. Do I have to do it? I said, you absolutely do not have to do it. And started the whole thing all over again. And this hospital was not much doing this. They were not thinking they were uneducated. They wouldn't know what to do. We got an old one here. Let's get it early. You know, that's the kind of attitude. So anyway, this is the one I was in. This case is even more unbelievable. This is the one that makes me feel that it's not a matter of time. There's some other driving force. However, LJ, which is this woman, still harbored hope that another treatment would become available, and she autonomously, I'll throw that word in, wished that in the event of cardiac arrest, everything be done. What did the patient want? Everything be done. She might have been crazy, right? She has terminal cancer, there's no hope, the doctors are telling her there's absolutely no hope, but she thinks, I still want to hold on for the possibility that something will become available. That's her decision. So what do they do? Her doctors felt frustrated and helpless in the face of her advanced disease. They promised to follow her wishes. They told her, okay, we'll listen to you. In the middle of the night, during the second week of admission, she experienced the cardiac arrest, and the code was called. Resuscitation was initiated because there's no DNR. Legally, they got to go through the motions. So she got a bag and mass ventilation, which tells you something right away. In a real arrest that's serious, you intubate as soon as you can. You don't play around with egg mask. And chest compressions were started. Epinephrine and atropine were called for by the resident, but were secretly injected into the mattress instead of the patient's intravenous.
Whoa.
After one round of medications, the resident ordered stop. We tried. Called the cop.
So
how unusual
so
is that?
Bad.
I bet that happens every day.
So, what was the justification? Autonomy?
Maybe if you're
the reason that they did this, they were respecting the autonomy of the patient.
She's not on the right to get much. They're not. She can't make decisions. So, yes.
So they're going to make her, they're gonna make her autonomous decision.
Right.
She was in full right of mind when she said, I
apparently
want
not.
Everything done.
Apparently not. She expected a cure to be ready. So apparently she was
you
not.
You can't say what she expected.
Whoa, guys.
Mike, there was advocate.
Fight.
Take care of it. I know you are.
Right.
No, no, no. The problem here is that she made this autonomous decision. I want everything possibly done. She was fully in control of how it all happens.
No.
She was not being
this was the decision made by the medical team, and I want you to know you're judging now, and I want you guys to realize something. That when you're residents and you're involved in this kind of situation, the temptations to behave this way are tremendous. It's a great sign because here's one where you gotta really bear down and remember who you are and what you're supposed to be doing. The resuscitation of a patient like this, you're thinking to yourself, after you've been through your 100th cancer patient who you know is terminally ill and not going to make it, involves incredible arduous labor for everybody and is replete with the experience of another person suffering tremendously. Right? So it is not, they're not crazy people. They're not horrible people. From where the perspective they're coming from, here's the devil's advocate. Here's where I'm dying in the process. They feel horrible every time they walk into that room with this poor person suffering that way.
So
that's what's really motivating them.
Selfish for them.
Okay, so they're making that decision, but the point is, it's not autonomy. That was my original point. It's not autonomy that's making this call here. Because the autonomy would have said she's willing to take it. She has that right. Even Rav Schechter would allow her to make that decision. You're going to see Rav Schechter in a case like this, where he will say, what would 999 out of 1,000 people decide in her position?
Otherwise,
most people would probably say,
yeah,
let me go. Just let me go. You know, in other words, the scenario is there's no hope, and your life is just one painful experience. So the majority of people would probably say, let me go. If Shechter's going to paskin, then in a situation like that, if I don't know what the patient wants, but 99 or 999 of 1,000 people would say, let me go, we don't care what anyone says, I'll be din, let them go.
Good.
It would be an avera to continue to support them. So we'll see, you know, Judaism is not going to be that far off from some of what you're going to feel is the right thing to do, but we got to come at it from the right direction, which means, you know, autonomy comes from the fact that the secular ethicists, in order to make these kind of difficult ethical decisions, they look to their standard of value. What is their standard? All the great philosophers of Western civilization. You're going to look at Aristotle, and I'm not kidding, Kant, Mills, Hume. They're going to look at all these philosophers, who is going to be the source of their ethical principles. Or they're going to look inside their own hearts. It's going to be a humanistic decision. Okay? You know, that's all they got. And that's how they're going to decide it. But what halacha is about is that the really hard questions we are participating in, right? Nothing's shoved down our throats. Meaning, we formulate halacha together with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we have to realize that the source for major ethical decisions for a person who is committed to the Torah is going to stem from the Torah. It's going to stem from Chazal. It's going to stem from the poskim. They are going to incorporate in their decision the derivation of what the Masorah is, what Hashem really is showing us, the direction of what really is ethical. Because ultimately, all the humanistic standards in the world are very subjective to your humanistic feelings versus my humanistic feelings. That doesn't mean a thing. Who says you're right? You feel one way, I feel another way. He's going to feel another way. Right? He's automatically going to feel another way. Right? Either way. But when it comes to Torah, just kidding. you have a universal single authority, and that was my little page 4 make me feel better plea. But people should realize that the decisions, we're going to see 6 shitos out there now. six different approaches. Lamaisa, what to do in these situations. They're all stemming from the same limited makoros. Page 5.
An anthropologist legally said,
don't worry about
that, I will not treat patients that if in such a condition they will not try to be honest.
Can somebody say that?
Yeah, I mean, can I say, I'm sorry, my belief is that I will not touch you if you're not okay with that, go to another doctor.
Well, what does happen is currently happening right now. There's a major court case right now. I think it's over because the patient died. Sometimes the doctors will take the family to court because the family is saying that we need to go on. We can't let you stop. And the doctor's saying that we must stop. And that'll become a court case, and the court will have to decide. That happens.
But
it's patient abandonment, right? Unless you can get a replacement and then with the consent. You're not allowed to abandon the patient unless American legal principles. If you accept the patient, right, you can't just abandon them without providing them with a suitable replacement.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about even before that. When you want the doctor's office, right? Can a doctor just
policy?
You
don't have before that you can do anything you want. You don't have to accept any patient. You don't want it. You don't like his nose. You know, it's an ugly nose. I'm not going to take care of it. Whatever criteria for deciding to accept the patient, you have the right to do that. I'm kidding about the nose.
Yeah. Really, really quick question, like sort of yes or no. So let's say there's like a DNR out, and then the doctors like decide not to follow,
Resuscitate him. That's what you asked me before.
So now he's on, but then they like put pressure to basically, like, he's a really old guy, and they put pressure to like take him off the resuscitation. You can't do that.
In the middle of it?
Now that they've already resuscitated him, right?
They'll have to wait for the next arrest. I mean, they can't.
Yeah, but what I'm saying. No. I'm saying like you shouldn't be able to take him off of a respirator, right?
Taking off a respirator is not a big deal in the secular world. In other words,
I'm talking halakhic people, though. I'm saying
in the halakhic world, it's a big deal.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very big deal.
Like if I'm a Jewish guy, and this is my
taking someone off a ventilator is going to be a big problem. There's one shita, and it's not. I told you the six shitas, so those are the six main accepted shitas. Then there are the fringe shitas. So one of the fringe shita, and there's only one, says you can actually take a guy off a ventilator. That's it. You're not going to find any of the people we're going to talk about. The most makil shita will not allow actively taking someone for a respirator because you will be killing them by doing that. You can't actively kill someone.
Yeah.
If you look at the top, great segue. At the top of page 5, I wrote 5 things that everybody agrees. I'm about to tell you 6 shitos. I'm going to give you 5 principles they all agree on. It's always good to hear what they're...
What if somebody says that while they're on the respirator, they're not really alive?
No, I mean they're... Are they dead?
Yeah.
Brain dead?
Yeah, I guess so.
That would be 3 lectures worth right there.
Or is their heart beating? If their heart's not beating, then they're dead.
Well, if they're... Yeah, I mean, meaning like...
Take them off. Bury them.
Meaning pulling the plug isn't really killing them.
If they're
dead? They're already dead.
That's true. Who would disagree with that? But not everyone has the same definition of death.
I think, are there shitas like that? Are there?
Oh, there. If someone's dead, you still can't take them off?
No.
You know something? There's a shita that we're about to see. Incredible as it may seem, we thought that he needed to give a heter to do that. If that's what you're asking, it's not so crazy. It's Tzitz Eliezer, we're about to see a shita. Actually, it's a shita that he understands a certain sugya, a certain way, that even if the guy's heart's not beating, we know he can't breathe. He's flatline EEG, he's no head. But all he has is this thing blowing up a balloon of his lungs.
Right.
That there's a chiddush that you can take him off. We'll talk about it in a second. But short of that, you know, who in the right mind would have a shot on that?
Right.
That person's dead. Once a person's dead, why on earth would you not take him off the respirator? They're dead.
Yeah.
When the Nishmas of Ram discusses this to Tzilezer, he could feel it in his writing. He goes, what am I supposed to do with that? You know, like, he's like, throw it up his head. What? You can't understand what it means. Person is dead. What do you mean? Don't take them off the ventilator. Right? Of course. All right. What does everybody agree on? Everybody agrees on the 5 following principles. 1, Ritzicha is asur. Everyone agree to that?
What's Ritzicha?
Murder.
Devil's advocate on that one, right? Active suicide. Usser. Passive suicide.
Usser.
Active euthanasia.
What's that?
What's that mean?
Usser. What is active euthanasia?
Are we going to talk about
that?
Assisted
suicide.
Assisted
suicide.
It's assisted very similar to... The person sees a man for no good reason. Just killing someone. It really is the same thing. But this one is... But the guy's really suffering. You know, Dr. Kevorkian. Right? Assisted suicide. That's what this is. That's awesome. Everybody agrees.
What's passive?
That was the one where I couldn't believe
like
they gave me
that
assignment.
Taking pills that you need to stay alive, but not really
the
when you, if you don't take them, that's passive suicide.
According to Allah, everybody, all she does is say, active assisted suicide is absolutely awesome.
But causing someone pain.
Sorry?
Causing someone pain.
Causing someone pain?
Yeah,
awesome.
So then,
wait.
Also if someone's suffering, you are causing them pain by not letting them go, aren't you?
I don't know. We'll get. I'm just telling obvious things now. We're working our way into the real shadow. We're working. That's the real shadow.
Right,
number five that everybody agrees.
The New Orleans case.
Which I thank you guys for. I wasn't going to introduce it, but now that I got
your
The fifth thing everybody agrees to, all the shittos from Kula to Chumra, agrees there is no absolute autonomy. We do not agree with that principle. Nobody would say, according to halacha, that a person has full autonomy over what happens to them. It's absolutely not true. Okay. Those are the five principles that everyone agrees to. I want, in terms of us, I'm going to simplify things. We're going to skip. Here are the sugyas that are relevant. We're really going to focus on three. The top one, nedarim, and the bottom two, Hilchos Shabbos, and the one you're there to the left. I'll tell you them outside. These three little sugyas is all anyone's going to really discuss, and we're going to get six major approaches to the three sugyas. Here they are. First sugya is famous.
Daito is basically saying that somebody who just wants a DNR because they want a DNR can't get a DNR. There has to be a basis for getting a DNR.
Any decision. Any decision has to do with your life. Any decision has to do with your life. It isn't so simple as we just say, on all decisions, you get to decide. Right? That's what it means.
Right.
There's no autonomy. You don't have that absolute control. There'll be certain areas where we'll give you control. Right? But this is saying it's not a blanket, blank check. Whatever you want. This is not like that.
Meaning, so in that case that we just read, that's problematic for people.
Which the woman with the other
kid. The woman that she said she wants to stay alive.
No, a lot of people would say in that case she gets autonomy. If the case was so extreme that she was making a crazy decision,
I thought it was.
Rav Schechter would say, no. I mean, the scenarios are very different. Depends on the details. But I told you Rav Schechter's opinion would be on that kind of case, where she's deciding something that 999 people would have made a different decision out of 1,000. And then that would be one where Batul Daito and Sokolata, we would say you can't make that decision.
Meaning, we'd go against her explicit decision to stay alive.
Correct. Others disagree with that. Others say, no, she has every right to do that. But let's go through them. We're doing this. Let me do it my way, trust me. Do this my way. You will be less confused.
It's like a slap in the face. We said
let's
organize. I want to stay alive. Keep me alive. No, we're going to kill you.
You know, guys, just listen. We have to understand what everything you're getting me like.
Sorry.
Without building it the right way,
it'll
be much more understandable. You have to see that there's going to be, let's say, these three major makaros. There's going to be six ways of understanding these three makaros that are going to fit into different ways of looking at these situations. And we'll see the flow. First sugya is Ksuvos and the Dara. In Ksuvos, the famous Gemara, Ksuvos at the end. Around Daf Kuf Dalid, you don't have that in front of you. But in the Gemara's over there, it describes the death of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, right? Different descriptions of what was going on at the time when Yehuda HaNasi died. Now, when he died, you have to realize this was a absolute shattering reality for the Jewish people. He was it. Yehuda HaNasi was as gadol ador as there could be. He was beloved by everybody. He was the holiest person. He was like, the way Lubavitch Chassidim would treat the Lubavitch Rebbe when he was alive, that's how everyone felt about Rebbe Yehuda. So that's why there's so much description and discussion about his death. It was such a difficult time. So he's dying. And the Gemara describes all this Talmidim and all the people are davening, he should stay alive, he should stay alive. And his amsa, his handmaid, who was a big Talmida Chachama. There are many Gemaras that talk about amsa to the Rebbe. She was a woman who knew her stuff. She's watching what's going on. And she's seeing Rebbe suffering tremendously, right? One way of looking, he had an intestinal illness, and he couldn't even put on his tefillin because he kept having these intestinal problems, and he was suffering tremendously. And she's watching, and she's watching them daven, and she's saying, he's dying, and the way she put it is, the Elyonim are Bikesh Rebbe, the Elyonim want Rebbe, and the Tachtonim are holding on. So originally, before she saw the suffering, she said, may it be Hashem's will that the Tachtonim win. People on the ground should win, keep them alive. Then the Gemara describes that she saw how much she was suffering. She changed her mind. She says, I'm changing my tefillah. I want the Elyonim to win. So she davened that the Elyonim should win. And so one version of the Gemara is, and it worked, and she died. And he died.
He died.
And he died. The other one is, no, they kept davening, so he was alive. So she took some kind of a pottery, smashed it to the ground. There was a sudden loud noise that made them stop, and he died. Either way, the implication is clearly, Amstel Bay Rebbe made the ethical decision, he's better off dead than alive. Why? Because he's suffering. The Ran in the dirt that you have in front of you brings this in to explain what sounds like a very difficult Mishnah. The Mishnah says in the Dharim, right? It's talking about a person who is moder hana from another person. I will never get hana from you. Right? It makes a neder like that. So the question is, can it be mevaker cholim or not? That's how the Gemara gets to the topic of pikur cholim. So it's telling me how important pikur cholim is. So it says, kol shei mevaker chole, ein mevaker shel avrachamim. Lo shiyichge velo shiyamos. He says, pikur cholim is really important. Why? Because if you're not mevaker cholim, like we learned, right, which is a great place to tefillah, you won't be davening that he should live or that he should die. So the Rishon goes, what does that mean, daven that he should die? You mevaker cholim, you're going to daven he should die. So the Ran explains it in what we all would have probably come up with also. It's talking in quotes, the Gemara Ksuvos, he says, Amstel Berebi, we see, she's right. That there's a time where the right thing to do is actually daven that the person should die. Daven that he should die. That's sugya number one. Sugya number two and three, right? In the middle, I'll just tell you quickly, are raya's from Chazal, that Chazal sometimes view pain worse than death. That's what these sugyas are. The proof that Chazal recognized that pain certainly could be worse than death. Right, a very famous sugya. Ksuvos, I don't want to go into it because I want to really just push to the end.
What about a dying?
You don't need to know it as much, but just I'm telling you what these sugyas proved was that Chazal recognized the fact that sometimes pain is much worse than death. Then we have the halacha in Shabbos is that even if a person is cut up completely and has moments of life left, you could be b'chal Shabbos to save his life. Right? That's on the one hand. That shows the sanctity of life, that every moment of life is so precious, no matter what your state is, you can be b'chal Shabbos to save that person. And that seems to be so sere, the following, here's our most, single most important makor is this Ramah. This is worth doing inside. This is really what it all comes down to. This psak in the Yerodea is, if you were only going to take away one thing from everything we do, this is the one. It says the following, Kol ha-ma'ametz mitzias ha-nefesh ha-reizeh shofech dam. Anybody who, in dealing with agosis, merely closes their eyes, that's what ma'ametz means. You go over, the agosis is dying and the eyes are open. You're getting prepared for death, so you want to get those eyes closed, right? So you do it while there's still a ghosis. You are a murderer. That's the difference. Don't touch a ghosis. We're going to emphasize this next week on Monday. When we talk about how to handle a ghosis, this is our starting point. It's murder to close the eyes of a ghosis because that could be an act of murder.
Check out
we'll see. The exceptions are, if you want to save him, you know, then of course you can do anything.
So wait, we just said that there is a time to die and that we learned that from review the Nasi. And you're right. So, but then she smashed the thing is one thing, and that's part of the things that we can't do for ghosts.
Yeah, she's not smashing it on him.
Yeah, no, because the noise. It's that noise.
No, but it's not directly affecting. She was just stopping them from davening. Her gender was just stopping them from davening. She was nowhere near Rebbe. They were off in the base medrash. Rebbe's out in his bed. She ran to the base medrash right outside the window. She made a loud noise. So they got started, they stopped davening, and then Mimela, he went. right? We'll see why is that okay, right? So listen to what the Ramah says. This is the important thing. So he says, okay, so the Machaber told me that I can't close the eyes of the Goses. You can't do anything to hasten the death of a person who's dying. Kigon Mishahu Goses Man Aruch. And the language here is very, very important. Somebody who's a Goses for a long time. Below Yuchali Hipare. What does that mean? What is Preda? Separation. The Neshama is not able to separate from the body. Asur lehishame takar ba'keses mitachta. You can't pull out the pillow from underneath him. You can't take out anything that'll move his body significantly. And mikoach she'omrim sheyesh notzos miksas ofo shegormim zeh. Right, there was some superstitious notion that certain feathers are keeping him alive. So you're not allowed to actively go pull those feathers away that are in the pillow in order to make his death happen sooner. These are things you're not allowed to do. V'chein lo yazizu min komo. You absolutely can't move him. V'chein asur lasum mavtechos beis hakneses tachas rosho g'dei sheyipare. And you can't do another sort of mystical thing that they thought would work, is that a guy who's a goses, who's in the shomah, is just not leaving yet. You can't actively take some keys from the shul, put it on his pillow in the hopes that that will make him die. Aval, here's really the key. So that, you can't do any of that. What can you do? In yesham davar shegorem iko yitzias anefesh. If there's something that is preventing, and the word choice is very, very meduya, preventing the yitzia, the leaving of the nefesh, kigon sheyesh samach laoso bias kol dofek, like let's say there was a woodchopper, that's the classic example. There's a woodchopper, constantly banging, and that's what's keeping this guy alive.
Like the tefillah?
Or kigon chotev itzim, a woodchopper. Oh, sheyesh melech al shono, or he has a very sharp substance, like some salt, that's a little tiny piece of salt on his tongue. Ve'elu ma'akvin yitzias ha'nefesh, and those items are preventing the neshama from leaving. Mutter lahasiro misham. You're allowed to stop the woodchopper. That's very analogous to what she did, right? And to take away the salt. The ein bazeh maise klal ela shemesir hamoneh. So here it is. This is the big Ramah that everyone has to deal with. So he's saying you're not allowed to actively hasten the death through movements of the body in any way, right, as a bottom line. But if something is considered being ma'akev, preventing the neshama from getting out, you let him remove the impediment.
But that sounds
like so now the big question goes, what's the big question? What on earth are you talking about? Right. That's what the big question is. What did the Rama mean here? What is this chiluk? It's all based in Shilte Kiburim, and it's based in other makoros, but this is the bottom line everyone has to deal with. The Ramah's Psak, he's saying certain things we can do, certain things we can't do. What I clearly can't do is actively move the body in a way and cause the person to die. What can I do? Anything that is just Hasar Samoneh.
So passive.
Removing things in a Ma'akim and Tzias in the
Shalom. It's passive, not.
But what does that now?
What exactly does that mean becomes the reason we have six sheet. So the six shitas are going to argue over what did the Ramah mean, and they're going to argue what do we learn from Amsa Deberim. So I want to give you quickly, in the next 2 minutes, a quick overview, and then we're going to get into more detail on Monday. Okay? Monday we're going to do all our time. All the practical hands-on stuff.
Is that what we're saying? Active versus passive? Is there
Well, we have a very superficial understanding of it right now. But what I'm interested in is, what are the poskim going to tell me about what this means? I have to admit, as an individual, when I read this Ramah, I often when I learn, I like to give my own guess. Like, what did the Ramah really mean? What does the Bishah really mean? And this one, I was like lost. It's more subtle than just active and passive. It's not just that. Some of the things he calls active sound to me like putting the keys from the Sakhnesis under the pillow, that's usur. What is that? And some of the things just don't make sense. Some things are very difficult to really formulate my own chiluk. And what's the proof that I'm not crazy? Because the six different shitas are exactly what he means. So take a look, I'm going to take a quick overview just to get us, so we can immediately start on Monday, finish this, and then talk about cases and cases and cases. And I'll show you that the key lesson of the whole thing, after we're finished with the six shitas, is you got to do it case by case, and you got to decide which shita you're going on. You really got to decide or meaning the family has to decide, the person has to decide, which is why when we get to talk about what kind of living will a person should leave, you should definitely have in there, you know, where you're holding on this.
Is that something where everyone as a doctor himself, if he's religious, has to, like, case by case choose?
You have to grapple with it, I'll tell you why.
Or I choose one shita that I follow?
In other words, I can't. Let's say the patient decides to follow one of these shitas to the makel side. But I personally followed one of the chavonot. That's not true, by the way.
No, I'm
just saying hypothetically. If that were true, I'd have a problem if I was going to be carrying out their orders. In other words, they can decide whatever they want. And that's what should take place. But I'm not going to be the one to do it. I have
I'm
to take
saying,
myself out.
I'm saying for you, if you look at a case,
doctor has to decide where they're holding.
You redefine your shita every single case you have?
No.
You
have a shita. I have a shita, and then I apply the details of the cases to my shita. Right? So quickly, I'll just tell you in 60 seconds. The way this booklet is made out is going from most machmir to most makir. The most machmir sheet is the Tzitz Eliezer. He's going to hold like this. Remember, each one is going to decide, what do I do with Amsa Debei Rebbe? What do I do with the Ramah? So you know what he does with Amsa Debei Rebbe? He's the only one that does this. He says, since when do we pass here? Like Amsa Debei Rebbe against all the Talmidei Chachamim that were davening for Rebbe to live. He says, we pass him like that. And the Ram, he's a Das Yachid. So he says, you can't even, this is a very unique shita, you can't even be the spala that the person should die. He's the only one that feels that way. Everybody else takes the sock of the Ram at its face value, the shita of Amsa Debei Rebbe is the winning shita. And every even Rabbi Blatt, who's going to be also pretty machmir, he's going to say, you can daven that the person will die. You don't make it feel like that. You say like this. You say, I'm davening that what's in his best interest should happen to the patient. You're thinking, probably best that it should be open. Right? But the Tzitz Eliezer doesn't even grant that, let alone to do anything. So what does he do with the Ramah? Here's where he comes up with that crazy idea. The Tzitz Eliezer, you know what he says the Ramah means? You know what Hasaras HaMoneh is? He describes a case where a guy is dead, but on a ventilator. That's what he considers. That's a radical approach. Because he says the Ramah is looking at a person.
Cardiac death?
Yeah, the modern equivalent would be his heart stopped, he's completely dead, but his we're being ma'akev to neshama because the Tzitz Eliezer is not thinking like a doctor. He's thinking totally in a very metaphysical way. He's thinking that somehow this machine is keeping the neshama in, right? No one else goes along with this, but this is really, really believed. I don't know if he's right or wrong. This doesn't sound normal to me, but he's really claiming that that's the only license he gives. It's an incredibly chamor shita. Suffering, too bad. Persistent vegetative state, too bad. According to the Tzitz Eliezer, I personally don't know anyone who passes like the Tzitz Eliezer, but I'm sure there were people at one time that would have asked him a shayla and they would have gotten a very chamor answer. We're going to see Rabbi Blach is not too far behind. Rabbi Blach is going to be very, very limiting also. And as we move across, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, which is the way I'm most comfortable, they're in the middle. Rav Schechter is one of the most makil, and Rav Zalman, Yochanan Goldberg, is the most makil. So we'll go over this because I'm not going to
I'm really